usual, I want to start by seeing what you have to say. You had a chapter of mine, mostly on whether amateurs will replace professionals. You had two, I think, quite interesting essays by Eric Raymond, one of which gets a little technical, but he warns you about the most technical parts and tells you you can skip them, and one of which ought to be of interest to law students because he's describing how the open source movement reinvented Lockean property law, more or less by accident, which is sort of fun. And then one blog post of mine, which I think is of some significance for the world, because if I'm right, the publishing industry is going to change quite radically in the next decade or so. That is going to be relevant to a lot of things. So let me start by seeing what comments or questions you have, if there's stuff in there you didn't understand and would like explained, and stuff like that. And if you all remain silent, I've got pages of notes that we can talk about. Anybody? Yeah.
I wonder if you've heard of the book kiosk where it prints your book on demand. It's a big box full of blank paper and printer, and it has various different files on it.
I think I have heard of it but not seen it. Do you know where it exists?
They're mostly in England right now, I think.
Uh-huh. And how is it done? That is to say, you're paying with a credit card or something.
Yes,
a
you
price
go to the vending machine of books, and you go to it, you look through the screen to see what you want. They have one at the airport. I think Heathrow has one. And you push the code to the one you want, and it prints it, and 5 minutes later you're booking it.
It's a long time for a dispensing machine, I mean. Other than being cool, what are its advantages?
It reduces the storage and upfront cost.
How many books does it have?
Digital files inside? I have no idea.
You don't know.
It's like a publisher.
If it's got thousands, then that's right. If it's got 15, then it would be cheaper to have. Because the problem is going to be that on that small scale, I would have guessed it's going to be hard to do as good a job of printing at the same cost as you can in a bigger facility. But no, I think I have heard it mentioned, but I have not actually encountered any of those. Anybody else? All right. In a sense, it isn't the way I put the chapter, but one way of looking at our subject is the way in which the world gets changed by the existence of very, very good communication technology, making it very easy for people to get together and coordinate. And one obvious implication of that is that the fraction of the population needed to produce critical mass for anything is much smaller. If you think about the fact that to achieve something, whether it's writing a piece of software or starting a business or playing a game, you need, let us say, 50 people. And if you can only associate with the people who are physically near you, you only get 50 people if at least 5% of the people around you share that interest. If you can associate with the world, you can have a vanishingly small fraction of the people and are nonetheless enough to give you your critical mass and do stuff. So that's sort of one of the effects. And one of the potentials for that, which I think is interesting and will be relevant to you, is what you might describe as a much more fluid lifestyle. I remember talking to my son, who's 30-ish and went to Harvey Mudd, which is a very techie school, and is saying that he and his friends think of their life in terms of projects, not careers. In terms not, I'm going to go to work for firm X and spend a lifetime or even 5 or 10 years for them, but here is something I want to do. When I finish doing that, I'll do something else. And that makes a good deal of sense, in a more fluid world that comes out of this sort of decentralized communication system. Before I talk about open source, which is one sort of spectacular example along these lines, a couple of things that I wanted to explain as background. First is the term hacker, because for those of you who actually read the Eric Raymond essays, which I hope you did because they're neat stuff, he uses the term hacker in a way that has nothing to do with computer intrusion. That as Eric and a lot of people in that world use the language, that's a cracker. That the original meaning of hacker in the computer culture is somebody who does things in an ingenious and unconventional way. So that it's basically a programmer whose specialty, so to speak, is ingenuity as opposed to pertinacity. So if you imagine that you've got some program and you've just figured out a way of making it run three times as fast. Now, it's a way that will probably break the next time the operating system updates or the next time the hardware changes, because it depends on some particular characteristic, but while it works, it works. I like to sort of explain what a hack is by imagining somebody who, for the first time, sees an elephant. He picks up things. How? My God, what a hack. Right? He's turned his nose into a hand. That's a hack. And so when he's talking about hackers, he doesn't mean people who break into computers. He means people who enjoy programming, are ingenious about it, are enthusiastic about it, and so forth. Second, how many people here have ever written a computer program? Curious. So about half, roughly less than half. For the rest, should I explain what the difference is between source code and object code? Because it's relevant to the term open source. When you write a computer program, you're writing it in a computer language which is designed to be written and read by human beings. So BASIC, Fortran, C, Java, these are all the names of computer languages. And a simple computer language, you might have X equals 7, which means there's a variable called X that the computer is going to keep track with, set it to 7. And then you might have Y equals X times X. Y is now 49. You might run through that same bit of code later, but then you've changed X to 3, and now Y becomes 9. All right, so it's written in a form which often looks sort of like algebra, a little bit like English, and designed to be readable and workable by human beings. APL is an exception. APL is designed to be writable but not readable, which is why they refer to it as the only write-only language, but that's a joke for a programmer joke. It's a weird language. Anyway, a computer can't run that code. Computers don't know algebra. They don't know English. So you have another program, which in one standard version was called a compiler, which is a program for taking the human-readable source code and generating from it what's called machine code. And machine code is a series of numbers. And what those numbers are codes for operations the computer does, and they say something like, take the number that's in memory location 7,223, put it in register A of the central processing unit, take the number in, put it in register B, add the numbers in register A and B, putting the result in register C, take what's in register C, put it in memory location 723, and so forth. So it's a set of very, very detailed, small-scale instructions for what the actual machinery is doing. All right? Machine language is not designed to be human readable. There are programmers who write in machine language, probably not as many now as there used to be, because the reason to write in machine language is that if you're good at it, you can write more compact code in machine language because human beings are smarter than computers are. But nowadays, memory is very cheap, and therefore people worry less about it. But basically, if you have the machine language instructions and you happen to be one of the few people who knows machine language, you can eventually figure out what's happening, but not very easily, because take from here and put here and do this with it is an awful lot of instructions before you get, what they're really doing is such and such. So normally, the computer programs you buy are normally in the form of machine language, alias referred to as object code. They are not easily human readable and would be very hard for a human being to modify. Because in order to modify it, you have to do what's called decompiling it, which is to go to reverse the process to figure out what these instructions are actually doing, then read it, then change it, then recompile it. Hard to do. On the other hand, if you have the source code, you can freely modify the program. If you have the source code and the compiler for that language, and there are lots of compilers out there, you can say, aha, I want to change it in the following way. Here's a game. In this game, the highest level your character can reach is 50, but this is where they set the highest level. I'll make it 55. I think this game would be more fun if it changed in this way. It doesn't have to be a game, anything you'd like. So, but it could also be, if you're a good programmer, you could say, well, look, this is a very nice program, but it just crashed. And if you're a good programmer and you have the source code and you look at how it crashed, you might be able to figure out, aha, the reason it crashed was the guy who wrote it made a mistake. And it's a mistake which only very rarely occurs, but when it occurs, it crashes the program. My favorite story of a bug was a program that I wrote, and I was writing it in a language which did not have a delay statement. A delay statement is a statement which tells the computer, wait 3 seconds and then do such and such. And so I wrote my own little tiny bit of a program for a delay statement, which basically said, read the computer clock, keep going round and round in a cycle until the clock is 3 seconds higher than it was when you read it, then go on. Is there anybody here who knows enough about the subject to know what the mistake was in that program? The clock shows the number of seconds since midnight. So I'm running the program, and the computer freezes. And eventually I look at what time it is and realize it's midnight. We're just past midnight. So the clock was reading 2 seconds before midnight. I told the program to run until the clock ran 3 seconds more than that. In 2 seconds it reaches midnight and resets to zero. So I referred to that as my Cinderella bug. And I went through and pumpkin-proofed the program. Changed it so it didn't do that. But that's sort of an example of the kind of thing which is obvious after the fact, but not at all obvious when you're doing it. And there are lots of bugs like that, which is relevant to some of the stuff that Eric is talking about the advantages of open source. All right, so the basic idea is that ordinary commercial software is distributed as object code. Microsoft doesn't want you tinkering with their code. And the open source movement instead distributes it as, it may distribute the object code as well, but it distributes it as source code, and one of the rules of the open source movement is, there are a couple of rules, but one of the most basic rules is anybody is free to modify and use this code, so that they are not using copyright law to protect their intellectual property. On the contrary, they are throwing that intellectual property out for anybody who wants it. Anybody can copy it, anybody can modify it, anybody can use it. A common restriction, however, in open source, I'm not sure if it's part of the definition or not, is that if you modify it, you must continue to make your modified version of the source code available. So that one of the things you're not supposed to do is to take the program that I spent months writing and then gave to the world as open source, put in some changes you think improve it, and then sell that as compiled code only, which nobody else can modify. Right, and there is at least the original open source license, which is called the GPL, General Public License, explicitly forbids that. And basically what it says is we're going to use copyright. We're going to use copyright to say your permission to use my copyrighted stuff is conditional on your not closing what you do with it. All right, and that's what Richard Stallman, who invented a good deal of this stuff initially, referred to as copyleft, as the idea that the software had to remain open. And so then how does the open source movement work? The basic idea is that somebody starts with sort of a baby version of a program. He starts with something that is far enough along to run, but it's not nearly far enough along for people to really want to use it. He makes that publicly available, and he invites the world to fix it. And anybody who wants can then take that code, modify it in ways he wants, and send back to the person who originated the modified version. The person who originated it then decides whether or not to accept the modifications. If he doesn't accept it, you're still free to use it. You can do anything you like with it. But whether he accepts it determines whether it goes into the version of the program that he is maintaining, which is the version that other people are going to go to when they want to modify it. All right? So it's an odd kind of ownership. It's an ownership enforced by norms, not by laws, because there is nothing to keep anybody from taking my program and doing what he likes with it as long as he doesn't close it. And I can't close it either, especially if I've got other people's stuff in it. But the basic rule is that the way we coordinate is that anybody can change it, but since everybody wants to be working on the same basis, there's no point in my making my improvements, which aren't going to work with the version everybody else is using. So each time I want to make an improvement, I look at the current code base, copy that over the internet to my machine, make my improvement, send it back. Yep. There was a question? That's fine. That's the basic mechanism. And Eric Raymond in The Cathedral and the Bazaar suggests two quite different models for how software is done. And that the traditional model that he describes that he used to believe in for all complicated projects is what he calls the cathedral. And that is you have some brilliant programmer or a team of brilliant programmers who work out the design for the whole thing, get everything working, and then release it, and maybe a year later improve it or find some bugs and fix it and release that. And that's like building a cathedral. What's a bazaar? A whole bunch of people he's doing his own thing. and how does the open source movement work? It's a bazaar in the sense that I'm an enthusiast for printer drivers, so I take Linux and I say, I don't care about the rest of Linux, I'm going to write printer drivers for Linux. And I'm going to send them in to Linus Torvalds, who's the guy who created Linux originally and maintains it, and he'll decide, and if he thinks it's good, fine, now my printer drivers are part of Linux. Somebody else is really good at floating point arithmetic, let's say, which is something that computer programs do. So he goes to Linux and says, the way Linux does its floating point arithmetic is just terrible. It's slow. It's inaccurate. I'm going to rewrite that chunk of Linux and send it in. So it's a bazaar in that sense. It's a decentralized system, but it's a decentralized system where you've got the sort of the coordinating mechanism of deciding what does or doesn't. It is possible to fork a project. Suppose I rewrite something and I think my version is a great improvement and the maintainer refuses to accept it. I've got the option of telling the world, here is my improved version, my Linux Plus, work on it. But they probably won't. Unless there's some obvious reason for the rest of the world, everybody wants to coordinate on the same version, and therefore, typically, that's going to fail. There are a few cases where projects were successfully forked, where there was some reason why some people wanted to do a different version, and accordingly, both versions ended up surviving and going on as further open source projects. As I said, the most famous example of open source is Linux. It was done by the original stuff was the Free Software Foundation, what's called the New Project, GNU, which I think stands for New is Not Unix. It's one of these three-letter acronyms where the first one is really redundant because it's just the first letter of the acronym. And it was done by Stallman. And Stallman is basically a world-class programmer. He is the sort of person, I'm not sure if he could literally sit down and write Microsoft Word himself, but I'm not positive he couldn't. But he was sort of very, very good, very original, somewhat crazy, and has his own odd ideological commitments. I've argued with him. He's an interesting guy, but a little bit nutty. And he decided that the solution to software that was copyrighted was simply to write from scratch his own software that wasn't copyrighted and give it away. And that was the original Free Software Project, and various other people got involved in improving it and doing it. That was quite a long time ago. And then the second round, as Raymond describes it, really starts with Linux, where Linus Torvalds, who has much less of an ideological commitment on these things, or at least a different commitment, takes someone else's public domain, open source, little tiny operating system, does some work on it, and then says, hey, world, fix this for me. And successfully got a lot of other people interested, hundreds, I suppose thousands in total, by Eric's description. At its peak, Linux was updating daily. That sort of every day, some fundamental changes got made, and he posted the new version. And Linux is now, I suppose, one of the, I guess, three main computer operating systems, at least for small computers. Mac, Windows, and Linux, I guess, is really about it for the moment. I'm sure there are some other things out there. And it's very widely used. A second project is something called Apache. Apache is a web server. It's the software that the computers that hold your web page are using. That's a web server. It's the software that when somebody accesses the web, what's he doing? His computer is sending a message to a web server saying, send me a copy of document X, which I will then display on the screen of my owner. And the software that does that, I think in more than half of all web servers, is Apache, which is an open source project. The Linux has a single maintainer, Linus Torvalds. I think it still does. It certainly did. Apache has a committee who are responsible for maintaining it. But other than that, the basic logic of what's going on is the same. And there are some fairly obvious problems which somehow open source manages to solve, and part of the question is how. And we start out with what economists think of as the coordination problem. All right, the coordination problem is the reason that our society can't possibly work and yet does. The coordination problem is that in order to achieve anything, you need to get millions of people all doing the right things that feed into it. So there's a famous essay a long time ago called iPencil, which is a description of how many people it takes to make a pencil. You know, it doesn't sound like a very complicated object, but pencil, you need wood. For wood, you need trees. To cut down the trees, you need chainsaws. To make the chainsaws, you need steel industry, and you need a gasoline refinery, and you need probably a plastics industry, and you need a whole bunch of other things. And you need the saws that turn the trees into pieces of wood of the right size for pencils, and that requires a bunch of other things, and probably some of that is electric, and so you need the whole... So if you think about it, to accomplish... You can go into the wilderness and, you know, pick wild plants that are good, and if you know enough, you might be able to start a fire by making a fire bow out of some pieces of wood and something else. I don't know what you use for string. That might get a little tricky. But for doing any of the stuff we're used to doing it, even though we don't realize it, we are relying on the coordinated behavior of millions of people. And the question is, how do you get it? How do you do the coordination? And the stuff that Eric Raymond is writing about, it isn't as complicated. That is to say, you can buy the computer. You have the open source people don't have to build their own computers. But just creating a piece of software as elaborate as Linux, where it's got to sort of work together, again, involves the coordinated behavior, not of millions of people, but of at least hundreds of people. So how do you do it? And there are basically two models for how you solve the coordination problem. The obvious model is central control. The obvious model is somebody says, here's what has to be done, you do that, you do that, you do that, when you finish, give it to him, and he'll do that, and so forth. And that's a workable model for small-scale projects. If you think about a football team, or a sole proprietorship firm, or various things of that sort, that works. The problem with that solution is that it doesn't scale. That it works worse and worse the bigger the project is, which is ultimately the reason the Soviet Union crashed. That if you try, it's the same model as at least the theoretical model. The Soviet Union really wasn't entirely being run that way, but in theory, the Soviet Union was a centrally planned economy, and people at the top tell everybody what to do, and they figure out, here's how much steel we need to produce, here's how many trucks we need to get the trucks, here's the tires we have to produce, so tell people to do all of those things. And that turned out to work very, very badly on the evidence, and I think at least some economists expected it to work very badly because of the difficulty of figuring out the answers to all of those problems. And it's a complicated interdependent system. So once you realize it's undoable, the answer is we're all dead because we've all starved to death long ago since nobody could possibly build all the things we need to function. The alternative solution, and the one which does scale, is some form of a decentralized mechanism, of which the most familiar one is private property and trade. It's not the only possible decentralized mechanism. But private property and trade, the basic rules are everything belongs to somebody. The way you get ownership of stuff to create it or to make a deal with somebody else who owns it who transfers it to you, or sometimes a few other ways, but those are the main ways. How do you coordinate stuff? If I need something from you, I offer you something in exchange. And it turns out it's not at all obvious. It's sort of a semester or two of economics. But you can get a decentralized coordination mechanism in which prices serve as signals, in which if there isn't quite enough copper being produced for all the uses of copper, the result is the price of copper in the world goes up, and somebody in Chile who has no idea what copper is being used for realizes that it would be profitable to reopen the copper mine that they closed a few years ago because it wasn't making any money, and lo and behold, more copper comes out. Or there's a copper mine that's functioning, and he says, all right, you should be working night shifts as well. And if you run through all of that, you have a very, very complicated decentralized system. It's not the only such one. You can think of ecology as a different kind of a decentralized system, not working on trade, but nonetheless in which you're getting effective coordination. So that's the basic sort of market model. And Eric is arguing that although you don't have explicit prices in the open source system, you do have a decentralized coordination mechanism which ends up successfully working. And the beauty, as I say, of the market system is that it scales. When you have twice as many people, calculating, you know, one way of thinking about it is you have twice as many people, you've got twice as many computers, namely inside our heads, figuring out the answers to all of these questions. because it's being done at the bottom, not at the top. And then the puzzle is, how does open source work when it seems to be missing some of the essential characteristics of a market system? Because no property, both the source code and the object code are open. They're public. Anybody can use them who wants them. There's no trade. Nobody is explicitly saying, I will do this for you if you will do that, this for me. And there are no prices. It's therefore obvious that open source can't possibly work. Because in order to produce a program, you need lots of expensive labor of skilled programmers. You need some kind of central coordination of somebody to put it all together. Therefore, Linux does not exist. Apache does not exist. The web does not exist. So what are the problems that the solution has to solve? And there are basically two related ones, which I can think of as incentive and coordination. The incentive is a reason to do things. And if you think about an ordinary market, prices are rather neat because they simultaneously solve those two problems. That the fact that the price of copper goes up not only tells me people need more copper, it also gives me a reason to produce it, because now I can make money doing something I couldn't make money at before. So you need an incentive, and you need some way of getting the right things done, of getting copper produced when copper is needed. So how do we solve that problem in the open source community? Part of it is that well-designed programs are decentralized, so that the program itself requires the minimal amount of coordination. As some of you, well, again, I can tell my own story. When I was doing programming, a long time ago, I wrote an economics textbook, and I thought up ideas for computer programs to teach economics. And nobody else was doing it, so I programmed them myself. And one very interesting experience, which sort of taught me some of what I was doing wrong, is I've been working on this program. The program has got, say, 10 pages of code, and I think I understand it. And then I go to bed. And the next day, you know, there's the program, more work to be done. What's this doing here? What's this doing here? What's this doing here? The point is that it's a structure which, as you build it, you think you can hold it in your head. As you build it, you say, well, this subroutine does this, this subroutine does this. The reason they're doing it this way is this. That's fine while you're doing it. But one night's sleep or maybe a couple of days doing something else, and you've got to painfully reconstruct the whole structure of this complicated interrelated object you've built inside your head. Very, very hard to do. And the solution, it turns out, which was developed and which there are a bunch of well-known languages that implement, is some way of decentralizing the structure of the program. This is, among other things, what's called object-oriented programming. It's what Java does and Objective-C and a bunch of other things. Of doing it in such a way that you have fairly small pieces, and as long as you understand that piece, while you're working on that piece, you don't have to understand the rest of the world. So that in the object-oriented model, the pieces are thought of as objects which send and receive messages. One of the programs that I did later, I had a larger project for doing more software, was modeling a supermarket with people trying to get out the lines. Because one of the arguments I go through in my price theory textbook is to explain why in a supermarket all of the checkout lanes will normally be about the same length lines. Because if one line is shorter, everybody goes to it, and that makes it longer. It's an equilibrium of very much like a market equilibrium. There are some exceptions. If you've got a line that's only six items or less, it might be faster, but sort of the rough. And I wanted to model that. I wanted to have a program which you could actually look down from the sky and watch the carts moving around. And the way you would do that in the object-oriented version is that you would have an object which is called a supermarket cart. It has a little internal data which says where it is and how much stuff is in it. And it then receives messages from the rest of the system, such as messages from each of the objects at the lane saying how long is the line here, and does things. And you write that object once, you then say, all right, I want 50 instances of it, 50 different carts, but they're all exactly the same code, and I don't have to look at this whole elaborate structure. What I'm doing, I have to do it a piece at a time. So if I were doing any programming nowadays, that's how I do it, but I haven't done programming for a very long time. But it's fun. One of the things human beings really like is building machines. It's sort of one of the human tastes, as it were. And building physical machines is a pain. because you're spending 98% of your time machining the wood or the brass or whatever it is, so everything fits together. And 2% on the interesting part, which is how does this thing work? Computer programming, there's still some of that, but it comes much closer to the pure case of, I have an idea, I'm going to put it, make it exist in the real world. So in that sense, it's really quite a satisfactory activity. If you ever want a really weird hobby and you haven't done programming, teach yourself to program. Do some programming. Anyway, so object-oriented languages are designed to make it as easy as possible to decentralize the development process by having one program working on this part, one part program working on this part, one program working on this part, and then the only centralized coordination you need is the one person who decides which outcome he likes. Well, you can see whether the code works better with that. He doesn't have to actually understand the insides of it, and therefore doesn't have to have the whole stuff in his head. And there's the what Eric refers to as Linus's law, which is, with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. That is to say, you have a program, there is something wrong with it. If a whole lot of people know different parts of the program in different ways, the odds are pretty high that once somebody spots the bug, there is somebody who says, of course, when I was working on this, I noticed there was this problem. It didn't matter to me, so... and then fixes it. So that's part of the argument for why Eric argues, I think, plausibly, the open source method works pretty well. The next question, though, is why would anybody do it? And there are a number of different answers that Eric offers. One of them is the commercial answer. One of them is that you, in fact, can make money at it. And his argument is that although we think of software in terms of things like Microsoft Word that gets sold, a very large fraction of all software is really what economists call an intermediate good. You're not producing the software for itself. The software is running the inventory with which you're producing couches. The software is helping you to do CGI movies. So the software is something that the person running the software isn't going to sell the software. He's just going to use it. Well, he says, if that's what you're doing, open source has enormous advantages. First, it's free. Second, if it isn't exactly what you want, you've got the source code, and if you've got a competent programmer, he can tweak it to do what you want. Third, if your expert on that software retires or gets married and moves across the country or something, there are other people who are working on the same open source project, and they'll actually hire one of them. So that there is a body of people who already have the information. Whereas if you wrote the software yourself, if you think of the alternative to open source, not as commercial software, but as proprietary software, as software where your company says, we need something to do this, so we'll hire some programmers to write it. Now, if those programmers quit on you, you're up the creek without a paddle, because it's going to take a long time for somebody else to get up to speed to figure out what their probably poorly documented code is supposed to do and how it works. So in that sense, there is a good reason why firms would like to use open source. Furthermore, and this begins to connect to the other set of reasons, suppose I'm using an open source program and I see a problem with it. It doesn't do something I want to do. I've got some slightly obsolete printer, and there's no printer driver, so I can't print from my software on my printer. If I'm an ordinary user, it's not clear I can do anything about it. If I'm one of the developers, not a printer driver, but just something else, and I send out a message to the sort of the list of people who work on this saying, hey, could anybody produce a printer driver for my old Epson? Well, I'm part of that community. The people who do printer drivers might someday need something I can do. It's a whole lot more likely that I'll get a response. All right, and that's the point at which we start thinking of it as what Eric refers to as a gift economy. An economy in which you get status by doing things or giving things to people and use that status to get other people to give stuff for you. Which is part of his model. It's a model that describes various things in the anthropological literature, and I think he's right that it's a model that partly describes what's going on in open source. So going back to the firm level, now if the person you hire not only knows the software, but is one of the programmers, is one of the developers on the software, of whom there might be hundreds for a big project, he's got access to resources you would like. He's got access to other people who are experts on other parts of the program and for whom it may be a 15-minute job to make the change that would have taken you weeks.
Earlier we distinction about the decentralized market
system
and coordinated, or I'm sorry, the centralized system.
Yes.
And you said that open source doesn't follow either.
Open source is not a market in the normal sense, and that we're not trading stuff for money, but it is a decentralized system in that many people are each solving a small part of the problem, and then whereas the market is the price system that coordinates them, in the open source one, it's the maintainer who coordinates them in the sense of deciding which changes are good enough to accept. But not in the sense of deciding what people do, because, you know, if you're one of those 200 developers, you say, well, here's a part that I think needs fixing, or a part I can improve, or an extension. You decide to do that because it's something you want. That is sort of somewhere Eric says that every good program starts with a programmer who has an itch he wants to scratch, with something he wants the software to do. Yep.
No, it's just that what you were just originally talking about, this concept of, like, you need to fix the X in printer.
Yes.
Will be favors for each other.
Yes.
You know, that
trading favors is beginning to look a little more like a market.
Like a market, and it's not based on price, but
it's not based on price. It's in a sense a less sensitive and easily worked system, but it's got the same logic to it. I think that's right, and that's getting into Eric's description of it as a gift economy. Think of as a kind of exchange. The if you read the Icelandic sagas, which were written down in the 13th century and are describing events for several hundred years before that, one of the things you very often observe is that what we would think of as exchange is done in the form of gifts. So that somebody arrives in Iceland in the fall and with a ship full of stuff, and he goes to some prominent local person and he gives them a bunch of stuff. And lo and behold, that prominent local person invites him to be his guest through the winter. And it's not an explicit exchange, but if he hadn't made some such invitation or some reciprocating gift, people wouldn't think very well of him. And there's a body of poetry written in Norse in the 9th century called the Elder Edda, and it's got a poem called Havamal, which is basically verses of wise advice written by the god Odin. And one of the verses is, no man is so wealthy that he objects to receiving a gift in exchange for his gift. So they know what they're doing, even though they put it in the form of gifts rather than trade. Not entirely clear why in some circumstances you do it that way. That I don't have a good answer to. But it is a sort of thing, a pattern of human behavior that one can observe. And I've observed it. I've been part of various gift cultures, of places where you... In fact, I'm going to spend this weekend teaching some classes on medieval cooking. I'm not being paid for it. I'm not even paid for my gas. But that particular set of hobbyists is itself, in effect, a gift culture. And I will, at various points, get other things back in response. Not in exchange, but as a result of being seen as a person who has status and is responsible and contributes to what's being done there. So, anyway. So, another way you can make a living, I should say, this question of how you can make a living out of this is an essay I didn't design called The Magic Cauldron. Which is another Eric Raymond essay. And Eric's also got a book called, I think called The Cathedral and the Bazaar, but it's really built up out of a bunch of essays, of which that's only one of them. He's an interesting guy, a little bit crazy like all the interesting people are. I think he thinks he's a reincarnation of the god Pan, or at least something along those vague lines. And yes, I mean that seriously. But anyway, so another way you can do it is by providing support. That Red Hat Linux is a, I gather, fairly large and profitable company, which is basically in the business of putting together Linux distributions, of saying, here is all of the stuff from this large body of free things that you are going to want if you are running a computer and want to run Linux and you're not part of the world and don't know what to choose. And if you have any problem, call us. So what they're basically doing, if you think of the open source stuff, of things like Linux, as the people who are doing it are almost all programmers, they're all insiders in this world, so you can be the go-between, the intermediary, who hires people with the job of knowing all about the open source and packaging it in forms that other people can use. And your package is still open source. It's not like you can violate the rules and close it, but that's all right because the people who buy the package from you are also buying support from you, and if they aren't your customers, you're not going to answer their phone calls. So that's another mechanism by which people are, in fact, employed in the open source world. So all of that part, almost all of that part, is really thinking of open source as a part of the ordinary commercial economy. But then, as I say, Eric is arguing that at the same time, you can also usefully look at it as part of a sort of a gift economy, where what is the payoff to contributing to an open source project? One payoff is what, as he says, is referred to in the science fiction fan community as ego boosting. That you get status, that people say, oh yes, I know who you are. You're the person who wrote that very useful chunk of code I've been using. I think I may have mentioned in this class that when I was here, one of the first years I was here, I discovered that the woman who was auditing my law and econ class was Sue Morgan, who with her husband wrote the software that I've been doing my taxes with for some years at the time. Well, she had a whole lot more status to me than everybody else in the room, even if hopefully that was not, well, she was auditing anyway, so I didn't have to grade her, but yeah.
So, sorry, I don't know anything about this. So
great, ask questions. Half the people in the room know about this and half of them don't. And if everybody who doesn't keeps quiet, they'll never find out.
So we have something building like Linux and this open source code. People are constantly making changes. Do they publish the changes that become permanent that, I forget his name.
Linus Torvalds.
These are the best and you want to find out.
There's a repository. There is somewhere on a computer somewhere, or maybe probably there are multiple copies. There is a huge library of code. And it at least includes all of the relevant software that Linus Torvalds has approved of. And anybody who wants can go there and download stuff from it. In the case of something like the Free Software Foundation, it's not just an operating system, it's a whole body of, it's not an operating system, in fact, Linux, as it were, plugged what was missing in the Free Software Foundation because they didn't have an operating system and everything else. But it's a compiler for C, a set of tools for writing C programs. I don't know. I'm not in that world. But a whole bunch of software. And somewhere there is, similarly, there's a source you could go to called SourceForge. And SourceForge is doing that on a smaller scale for lots of projects. So if you want to start an open source project, you go up on SourceForge, and I haven't done it, so I don't know the details, but basically you set up a little bit of SourceForge, which is your open source project. You put your stuff up there. Other people download from it. Other people upload, and you, presumably, if you're the maintainer, decide what goes there and so forth. So that's the basic mechanism, is that it's, as it were, you're writing a whole bunch of stuff, making a big pile of it, and putting it where anybody in the world can grab it. That's the machinery, as it were. That's a good question. Right. So if you think about it as a gift culture, my favorite story on sort of non-pecuniary payoffs is actually an Eric Raymond story. That Eric was giving a talk on open source at Stanford. This is probably 5 years ago, 6 years ago, maybe more than that. And he was a very prominent person in that world. Eric is also a libertarian, and I'm a libertarian, and I'm fairly prominent in that world. And I don't know if I'd ever met him before, but we had probably corresponded at some point. So I attend Eric's talk. And at the end of the talk, as often happens in a talk, people crowd around the speaker with questions. And I go up and say, hello, I'm David Friedman. And he looks and he's, David D. Friedman? And I could feel my ego go up. All right? And I got a free Chinese dinner out of it, because the people who had organized it took me out along with Eric and a few other people to one of the local Chinese restaurants. But that was sort of deep, because you could sort of see subjectively what that non-pecuniary payoff felt. It was status, the knowledge that you had status, and then there are, obviously, as in the case of the Chinese dinner, there are payoffs to status. Yeah.
Can I point something out here, though, that in the world of strong privacy, you want to get that ego boost if you were concealing who you were?
Sure I will. I just get my ego boost through my online identity, rather than through my physical personality. That there's no reason why, look, suppose you wrote a book, and suppose it was successful, and you saw reviews, and this is a wonderful book, it's such a beautiful job. You don't have to ever meet those people to feel good. All right? So from that standpoint, I mean, maybe I wouldn't get the Chinese dinner, it's true. But you might get some online equivalent of the Chinese dinner. Somebody might do some other favor for you. But in any case, the basic idea is that you have it's a gift culture, both in the sense that you're getting status, but also that status is implicitly tradable, in the sense that other people then do favors for you because you're known to be somebody who does favors, and they want you to like them because you might do some favor for them in the future and so forth. So in that sense, it works. It works. It works pretty well. Now, there are also other payoffs that if you get status, you may be invited to give a talk. I wouldn't be surprised if Eric was paid for the talk. I don't know if he did. You might write a book. You wrote a book on this stuff. You might be a consultant. If you're known to be the famous expert on X, people who want to know about X. Eric mentions that when Mozilla, which is what only spawned Firefox, what basically happened was that Netscape Navigator had been the leading web browser. It was being wiped out by the Microsoft web browser, and Netscape made the courageous decision to switch it to open source. And it didn't work very well for the first couple of years for reasons that Eric goes into, but eventually the Mozilla project produced Firefox, and I'm not sure if Firefox is currently more or less popular.